It's 4:06. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. I'm Rob Ferret.
And I'm Veronica Rickard. Coming up, a unique gathering this week. Native American leaders from across the state will partner with UW researchers to confront environmental challenges.
First, we look at a mostly hidden history of Milwaukee. The mafia operated out of most big American cities at one time or another, and Milwaukee is no exception, though that history doesn't get as much attention as its big city neighbor, Chicago.
Our next guest is out to remedy that. Gavin Schmidt is the author of the book, The Milwaukee Mafia, Mobsters in the Heartland. He's speaking at Boswell Books in Milwaukee on Saturday, March 14th at 2 p.m. Gavin, welcome to Central Time.
Thanks for having me.
Well, how big a presence did the mafia have in Milwaukee over the years, maybe in comparison to other cities like Chicago?
Well, compared to Chicago or New York, it wasn't as big, but obviously that's more or less a population thing. The size of Milwaukee has never gotten anywhere near the size of Chicago or New York.
So how widespread would you say it was in Milwaukee?
In the early days, it was more focused in the Third Ward, which is sort of around the Summerfest grounds. As the years went on, it spread and throughout the state and had effects on surrounding areas, even Las Vegas.
I want to talk about the Third Ward because, you know, these days Milwaukee's Third Ward is kind of a cool, hip place. It's got, you know, shops and restaurants. And it sounds as though in the past what you're talking about, it was more of a hub for the mob. How did the Third Ward end up being the home of the mafia in Milwaukee?
Well, I'll try to keep this short. There was a fire in the Third Ward in the 1890s, so nobody wanted to live there. Coincidentally, it's the same time the Italians started immigrating to Milwaukee. Being the new immigrants, that's where they set up their housing, which was terrible housing. But if there's one thing the mafia loves to do, it's prey on innocent people who, you know, need all the support they can. So it was a prime picking ground for them.
And who was the first mafia boss out of the Third Ward?
His name is Vito Guardalabene.
And tell us something about him.
Vito came from an area in northern Sicily. He came to Milwaukee in the early 1900s. He was thought of as the king of the Third Ward. If you wanted to do anything in the Third Ward, if you wanted to get a job, if you wanted to get a bank loan, if you wanted to do anything, you pretty much had to go through him because he had the connections that would make it happen.
Are there any particular stories that you associate with Vito Guardalabene?
I don't know about specific stories. A lot of it was facilitated through his two sons. So connecting him directly to anything is difficult.
Well, the name Vincent Crupi is one that you think we should know when it comes to the history of the mob in Milwaukee. Who was he?
Vincent Crupi ran the Red Light District in Milwaukee, which was on Water Street in the 1920s. Pretty much all of Water Street was brothels at the time. And Crupi is an interesting character, not only for running the brothels, but for how much lenience he got when he was finally put in the House of Correction. When in the House of Correction, the police kind of looked the other way, and he would go on day trips to visit his wife. And then as long as he checked himself back in by the end of the day, nobody cared.
Well, so why did he get that special treatment?
Well, he wasn't the only one. There were a handful of bootleggers who also had that. There were just people who were locked up, and for whatever reason, the guards didn't care. They were probably getting a little bit of money or alcohol on the side, and things were a little more lenient in those days.
Now, counterfeiting in Milwaukee sounds like it was a mafia-influenced activity pretty early on. What's some of the history there?
Counterfeiting is a very interesting thing. Today, as everybody knows, it costs more than a penny to make a penny. But in the early days, it was very interesting. You could melt down a piece of silver and make, you know, a silver dollar or something even larger if you wanted to. So you could basically melt down a quarter, turn it into a dollar, as long as you had the right kind of mold to do it with. So it was like you could literally make money just by doing that. It's an amazing thing.
Garbage collection early on in Milwaukee was influenced by the mob, it sounds like. What's the connection there?
The connection is that, again, the Italians immigrating in the early 1900s, it coincides with the time of garbage collection starting up. Prior to that, people would drive out of the city, load their garbage up onto their horse carts, and burn it out in the countryside. But garbage collection started up, and the garbage dump was actually, again, where the Summerfest grounds are now, which is kind of funny. But, again, because the immigrants got those jobs, it all had to go through the mob, because the mob ran the city garbage dump, and they hired the haulers, they hired the dump managers, anyone who wanted that type of a job, which was pretty much everybody arriving off the boat at that point, had to go through Vito Guardalobene and his two sons.
And one area we haven't talked about yet is, a time period, the Prohibition era, which would pretty much be associated with the zenith of mob activity. Was that true in Milwaukee, too? Was there a bootlegging operation, for instance? What was it like then?
Absolutely. Prohibition, like whether or not it was the highlight of the mafia is debatable, but it's definitely when they made their most money, at least initially. They had these amazing connections set up through Canada, Chicago, Detroit, Buffalo, and obviously people had home stills and could make beer and whiskey at home, but Canada had an interesting law during Prohibition where they had a prohibition of their own, but they didn't have a law against exporting it. So Seagram's, for example, would still export their alcohol. You just had to find somebody who was brave enough to bring it across Lake Erie or wherever and get it into the States. So the mafia came in at just the right time with these perfect networks because they knew people throughout the country who weren't afraid to run things in their cars.
So that was part of it, too. Well, how did you go about researching all of this when it's a history that prides itself on being secret?
I'm very lucky. We have something in this country called the Freedom of Information Act, and it allows me access to FBI records, police records, any number of things that, are set up by city or federal governments who are tracking these people. And it's amazing how many of these files are out there that never led to arrests or convictions. A lot of them are just daily reports of following these guys around. So there's so much out there that was being kept on these guys day to day that's never seen print before, because unless they got arrested or convicted, it never made the newspaper. So it's just an incredible wealth of knowledge.
Do any of the mafia lines that you write about still have traction in the city of Milwaukee today?
Well, that's a debatable subject. I can tell you that there are people who were active in the 1980s who are still alive today. I don't know how active they are today, and I'm kind of remiss from discussing any ongoing activity there may or may not be.
Mm-hmm. Well, we'll leave it there. Gavin, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks so much for having me, Veronica.
We were speaking with Gavin Schmidt, a Wisconsin-based writer, the author of The Milwaukee Mafia. He's speaking at Boswell Book Company in Milwaukee this Saturday at 2 o'clock and at both Barnes & Noble stores in Madison next Saturday, March 21st.
First, just over 100 years ago, American Indian leaders met at the UW-Madison to discuss issues of concern, things like Indian rights and conditions on reservations.
That historic meeting led the UW to extend the Wisconsin idea to tribal communities, a move that initiated projects like the agricultural collaboration, the archiving of Native language texts, and establishing the UW-American Indian Studies program.
Today, Native American leaders and UW researchers convene again at the UW Native Nations Summit on Environment and Health. With us now are two people involved in this summit. Janice Rice is Outreach Coordinator at the UW-Madison's College Library, past president of the American Indian Library Association. She's a key organizer of the summit. Janice, thanks for joining us in the studio. And also joining us is the main architect of the summit, Larry Nesper, a professor of anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW-Madison. Larry, welcome to you as well.
Thanks. It's good to be here.
So let's start with you, Larry. You, I gather, had been incubating this idea for a bunch of years before this happened. Where did this idea first come to you?
I was walking up the hill, Bascom Hill, with Tina Danforth, who was chair of the Oneida Nation at the time, and she admired the beauty of that and said she had never been up there before. And it struck me that the chair of the Oneidas has never been to our campus in her official capacity. And I began to think at that point that we needed to have an event that would bring together the tribal leaders at this research institution for some kind of summit. That's where it began.
And Janice, you are involved in organizing this. You're a member of the Ho-Chunk Nation. What aspects of Ho-Chunk culture inform things like the environmental practices and stewardship that'll be part of this conference?
Well, we'll have our tribal leaders here to talk about those topics throughout this evening and tomorrow. And one of the things that they will touch on is all the environmental issues that have been important in the state and the region. So I believe they'll be talking about the cultural practices and the environment and the way it impacts on the ceremonies that we have and all the natural resources that are valuable to us as American Indian people.
And Larry, we mentioned that there's a precedent for this just over 100 years ago in a similar gathering. It led to some initiatives, including from President Woodrow Wilson. So taking this conference today and tomorrow, what kind of outcomes do you hope to see as a result of this summit?
100 years ago, we were on this campus, these leaders were on this campus to talk about federal Indian policy. Mm-hmm. We don't really have that aspiration. What our aspiration for this event is for looking at opportunities and possibilities for collaborative research, issues that the tribes are concerned about within their communities, issues that we're both concerned about together, bringing the research capacity of the university together with the interest and the needs of the tribal nations. So we expect concrete proposals for research projects to come out of this in the area of environmental issues as well as health issues, perhaps others as well.
And Janice, do you see key environmental or health concerns that you're hoping to see progress on starting with this summit today and tomorrow?
Well, I guess that I would have to tell you a little bit about the health issues that I know of that are prevalent in American Indian country. Diabetes is very high, and most recently, heart disease and cancer have the rates have risen in our American Indian communities. And so we know that the quality of the water and the environment is very important in our lives. And so I know they'll be touching on those issues as we go along during the summit.
Do you think we've seen enough, Janice, cooperation between the UW and Native communities around the state in recent years? Or is there a need for a lot more of it?
There's always a need for more. There's people that are beginning to do more research and contacts out there, and some of the original contacts that were made way back over 100 years ago have gotten strengthened just by some continued connections that happened way back then. But we still need to revive and renew some of those, and also new areas will develop, I'm sure, and there's connections that have been made along the way with research, also service learning, and all the different outreach activities that have been happening. So I am really grateful for the programs that have been going on, but we always know more can be done.
And Larry, I wonder, is this something, this kind of summit, something that's unique here in Wisconsin? Is there precedent elsewhere in the country that you know of?
I don't really know about other precedents, although I guess we just read about something going on at the University of Washington that may be something along this lines. I think that there's a lot of research relationships between universities and tribes. We've certainly had a number of them going back, you know, almost 100 years, actually 100 years now. We've never seen ourselves as a community of researchers, and I think that's one of the aspirations for this conference, is for all of those people who have been involved, who are involved with the tribes, to see each other as a community.
And the Wisconsin idea itself is in part extending the boundaries of the university to the boundaries of the state. And as I've read literature about the summit, that the intention here is to include tribal communities in that Wisconsin idea. Can you talk about the importance of that a little?
That's very important. This was one of the original motivations of this, is recognizing that the tribal families are as much a part of this state as any other families, and in the spirit of doing work that will be of benefit to citizens within the state, the tribal nations needed to be included within that.
And Janice, what do you think could be done to improve that communication, to build that partnership more strongly, when the summit is over?
Well, I think there's several different ways. When you think about the faculty that'll be involved in this conference, I'm sure that they will be able to take some of the things that are discussed at the conference and follow through on some of the suggestions that will be made. We also have staff that are looking at that already, and maybe connections are already being made and maybe strengthened. And then we have our students, our younger generation, that are just, some of them are involved in this in some small way, but here their ears are listening, their eyes are watching what's going on, and there are future researchers and faculty in the state, or the nation even, depending on where they would go from here. But I think there's lots of potential.
Now, I know there's a lot going on starting tonight and through the day tomorrow. I want to get kind of a preview, a taste of what's going to happen. And now you can decide which one wants to tackle this first. The keynote address, I think, is tonight. What's happening?
That's right. Jacqueline Pata, forgive me if I'm mispronouncing her name. I haven't heard her say this or someone say this yet, but she is the executive director of the National Congress of the American Indians, which, by the way, is an institution that goes back to the 40s and emerged some ways out of the Society of American Indians from 100 years ago. She is giving a talk tonight called Flipping the Script, Tribal Nations Driving Research, and is addressing herself to the very issue that we're working on with that. She, Lawrence Roberts, will also be here. I believe he's Deputy Secretary of the Department of the Interior for American Indian Affairs. National level, federal level official will be here as well and making some remarks in sort of setting the frame of this event. There will be, then we start tomorrow in the morning with an invocation given by a Ho-Chunk elder and drum, and some opening remarks by Paul Robbins from the Nelson Institute, myself, Patty Lowe, and then we proceed immediately to the chairs forum, where the tribal chairs and their representatives will be speaking about issues of concern within their communities. We then go on to 12, 13 faculty presentations, people who have recently done or are doing research with the tribes now, as kind of showcasing the possibilities for relationships.
Now, as I understand it, going back 100 years again, the organization that participated in that event in 1914 was the first Native American advocacy organization made up entirely of Native Americans.
That's right.
So how important is it to have, I could see there have probably been efforts over the years from the outside saying, here's what you need, here's the help you need from us. How important is it to be hearing Native American voices driving that, Janice?
I think it's extremely important. When you look at the history of writings about American Indians, you'll see that not that many authors have been Native Americans themselves, if you look at the percentage. But with more researchers coming out and writers, authors, and faculty members, I think we'll start to see more publications coming out from American Indian people themselves. So the voice is very important, because we see that we are not as well represented in the academic circles as far as the voices go. So it would be good to have that continued voice, not be silenced, but hear more loudly.
If I could just add to that, the last phase of the summit is going to be 8 breakout sessions on topics that emerged from a joint planning conference between tribal representatives and university officials last year. So we will be talking about issues like mining and health and environment and education, agriculture, etc.
And you mentioned education. Is there an effort to try to create a positive pipeline, trying to get Native American students through the education system into UW and to become the researchers who are participating in events like these?
We hope there will be. We used to have more in terms of admissions, but it was more like just come to the campus mm-hmm. and be a student here. We haven't really focused on be a researcher, come here, do all this. I mean, to a certain extent we might, but I don't think that's been as strong as it can be, and I think this will help define that a little bit better. So when someone does go out and recruit, it's a little more tailored to that kind of concern and the needs of that community. So I think this will be very helpful to all of us.
So, Larry, this summit is today and tomorrow. What's the next step when you've come out of these sessions? What happens next?
The last part of the summit will be to come up with concrete proposals for future dialogue and future exploration of the possibilities of research. We really hope to narrow things down to getting to the level of people talking about grant proposals that might be made and particular issues and groups of people identifying themselves and stepping forward and saying, we want to work on this project with you. It's really about developing relationships. This is really what this is about. Developing those relationships, taking recognition of those relationships, celebrating those relationships.
Well, Larry, thank you so much for joining us today.
Great to be here.
And Janice, thanks to you as well.
Thank you very much.
That was Janice Rice, Outreach Coordinator at the UW-Madison's College Library, past president of the American Indian Library Association, and Larry Nesper, Professor of Anthropology and American Indian Studies at UW-Madison. They're both organizers of the UW Native Nations Summit on Environment and Health. It kicks off today on the UW-Madison campus.
Coming up, police rallied yesterday in support of Madison Police. After the news, we'll get police perspective on the reaction to the officer-involved shooting death of Tony Robinson. I'm Veronica Rickert.
And I'm Rob Ferrett. You're listening to Central Time here on the Ideas Network of Wisconsin Public Radio. First, supporters of Madison law enforcement held what they described as a peaceful gathering yesterday outside the state capitol. It's the first known organized rally in support of Madison police since the officer-involved shooting death of Tony Robinson last Friday. While a couple hundred people showed up, some carrying signs with messages like Blue Lives Matter, a handful of counter-protesters also showed up to voice their anger with the department.
Jim Palmer was at that rally yesterday. He's the executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. Jim, thanks for joining us today.
Thank you for having me on.
Why was it important to you to be at that rally yesterday?
Well, the rally was interesting for a few reasons. Perhaps first and foremost, it was actually organized by civilians, people who do not work, they're not law enforcement officers themselves. And they organized this through a Facebook page that they created called We Stand with the Madison Police Department. And they actually contacted me yesterday and asked if I would be willing to say a few words. And I thought it would be a good opportunity to just express general support for the law enforcement community without, you know, the event was not meant to diminish anyone's views or disparage anyone or any one group. And it certainly also wasn't to make a declaration about the recent tragic incident that occurred here. It was just to remind officers that there is a lot of support in the community for the jobs that they do.
And have you heard anything about how Officer Kenny is doing? Officer Kenny, the officer involved with the Tony Robinson shooting.
He's doing as well as I think can be expected under the circumstances. Obviously, it's a stressful point in time for him and his family. But he also recognizes that there's a community that has a wide variety of questions and concerns and legitimate concerns. And, you know, those questions, they kind of go hand in hand with the authority that law enforcement officers exercise in an effort to keep us safe. So it comes with the territory. Law enforcement officers are used to that. They expect to be held to a higher standard. But certainly it's a stressful time for him. But he's doing relatively well.
Now, the timing of this rally, along with what may or may not be seen as its purpose, have taken some criticism. I'm just going to share with you one comment that was posted today on a Facebook page called Ferguson to Madison. And it says, "What I don't get is rallying for a person who has just killed another human being. Why are you marching and shouting for a person who just killed someone?" Jim, what is your response to that?
Well, obviously that's a quote from someone who wasn't at the event because it was not meant to celebrate or recognize any one person. It was about law enforcement officers generally. And that was very clear from the organizers, and my remarks were the same way. It was just to express general support for the law enforcement community and the men and women who do that dangerous job.
Why have you weren't involved in the organizing of it, but what about the critique that it was on the same day as this other rally for people who are supporting Tony Robinson's family and organized by and other organizations that were helping?
Sure. I don't know when that other event was planned. I do know that the We Stand with the Madison Police Department group began trying to, you know, start organize this event last Sunday, and so it's my understanding that the pro-police rally, if you will, was scheduled beforehand.
And police, not just in Madison, but in cases around the country, are being accused of being too quick to pull the trigger. What do you wish people understood about police use of deadly force that they may not already know?
Well, that's a broad question because, you know, any use of force is complicated and has to be considered on a case-by-case basis. You know, we have the benefit here of a law that mandates an independent and transparent investigation. It's the only law of its kind in the country. In fact, it's a law that the Wisconsin Professional Police Association and the entire law enforcement community here in Wisconsin lobbied for and supported. In fact, the president's task force on 21st century policing just last week presented a report to President Obama and highlighted the Wisconsin model. So I think, you know, we believe that, you know, these cases have to be evaluated on a case-by-case basis. But certainly people have to, we hope people will take the time to learn the facts when they become more available, because the facts really do matter.
Can you tell me more about that Wisconsin law and how it's different from what we might see in the rest of the country?
Sure. And, you know, it's even a difficult question to answer because I don't think any one person anywhere in the country can tell you what the predominant investigatory model is. In fact, that was one of the recommendations that I made when I was asked to provide testimony to that task force. So I think we need to, you know, someone needs to do, the federal government probably, needs to do a state-by-state analysis assessment of what the different systems are. I think we have a very good system. It used to be in Wisconsin prior to April of last year that a department like Madison could investigate itself. It had the experience, the resources, and the manpower, and the expertise to conduct a complicated investigation like that. But, you know, people had, in the community, had, I think, reasonable concerns about the credibility of that and the appearance of that. And for that reason, we thought that there was a better way that we could do this, that this could be done, rather. And I'd like to think that the WPPA and the law enforcement community, in working with citizen advocates, was a genuine agent of change.
Now, going back to the use of force in this instance and in general, without speculating too specifically about the Tony Robinson case, is it possible for an unarmed suspect to pose an imminent threat of life that would warrant the use of deadly force?
Absolutely. In hypothetically speaking, of course, because I don't want to speak to the specific facts in this case, you know, an unarmed individual, if he's attacking or she's attacking an officer, can become armed in a hurry. And there are cases that, that I think demonstrate that each and every year. And, you know, frankly, a police officer, even though they may have a weapon, if they're disarmed and, you know, their assailant takes it from them, obviously the dynamic changes very quickly.
So the concern there is that the person would become armed during that interaction.
Absolutely.
And if you look at some of these cases nationwide, if we look at the step back, take a look at the big picture here, cases like Michael Brown's, Eric Garner's, Dontre Hamilton's, some of the frustration has come because in none of these cases was the officer charged with or convicted of a crime. And some analysts have said it's just really hard to indict police officers. Is this something that needs to be looked at?
I think it certainly is worth looking at, and our organization has been open to that. That's why we were such a critical actor in changing the law here in Wisconsin. But the fact of the matter is law enforcement officers are given some discretion, and it's up to, in this case, the district attorney to evaluate whether or not that discretion was reasonable and lawful, and that's something that remains to be seen.
Now, police in Madison and across the country, this is something that it seems like a sensitive time for everyone involved, the communities that are being policed and the forces themselves. How would you say this is affecting, I guess, just the mood of police forces in Madison and elsewhere?
That's a great question. I think, you know, the fact that we had that rally and there was a need for that rally yesterday perhaps helps answer it. You know, law enforcement officers, like I said earlier, do recognize that they ought to be held to a higher standard, that you know, goes to the fact that they do exercise an immense degree of authority in their efforts to keep us safe. Having said that, when you know, people in the community, most of which in Madison, fortunately, have been reasonable and measured, and people do have the right to express concerns. Sometimes when it gets personal and officers are called you know, vulgar names and murderers and that kind of thing, I don't think that's constructive, and I don't think that does anything to further the dialogue about how the law enforcement community serves the public.
Would you agree that there is room for improvement between, say, the Madison police force and minority communities, and maybe in general across the country, based on what we've seen so far this year?
Sure. Well, I think that the Madison Police Department is, I think, quite clearly one of the most progressive law enforcement agencies in the country, certainly in the state of Wisconsin. I mean, they have community-oriented engage in community-oriented policing efforts going back decades. And they have made great strides in making themselves available to all members of the community and making themselves accessible and making them a part of the process. And I think, you know, because that's true, I think that's why we're seeing, you know, a measured level of public expression of concern.
You said that Madison is one of the most progressive. What sets it apart? You mentioned some community interactions that have served them well. What else would you point to?
Well, right now, for example, the Madison Police Department, in conjunction with Dane County, is going to be starting a community courts pilot program. And it's kind of a diversionary program for young people between the ages of 17 to 25. If it's their first offense, they would be eligible to be considered for this program. And you know, maybe the instead of a citation or an arrest, which would be held in abeyance for the purpose of this community court, you know, they would be asked to do some kind of educational offering or, you know, some kind of community service. And if they fulfill those obligations, then nothing goes on their record. And I think, you know, the proliferation of programs like that, I think, can really benefit our criminal justice system as a whole.
Police in Madison have been criticized by some groups like the Young, Gifted, and Black Coalition for contributing to the racial disparities in Dane County. And Dane County has one of the highest rates of black incarceration in the country. And Chief Mike Koval said his department right now being blamed for everything from male pattern baldness to global warming. He said that on our show earlier this week. To what extent is the police department responsible for contributing to racial disparities?
Sure. Well, if he's responsible for baldness, I'm bald myself, so I'll have to have a conversation with him. But in all sincerity, I think, there are racial disparities in not only in Madison but in Wisconsin and in communities all throughout the country. Madison is unfortunately not unique in that regard, and this is something that is systemic. And there really ought to be a broad dialogue, public dialogue about this. And law enforcement has a role certainly in that dialogue, but we also have an achievement gap in our public school system. And, you know, there are issues involving sentencing clearly that need to be evaluated and discussed. So Madison's not unique in that regard, but what does make Madison, the Madison Police Department in particular, unique is, you know, it is much more demographically representative of the community it serves. It has it utilizes these, you know, neighborhood policing and community oriented policing practices to a tremendous extent, and it really has in many ways made itself, and the Chief Koval is a great example of that, a shining example of that, of making himself available to members of the minority community to make sure that their voices are heard.
With this shooting of Tony Robinson, the temptation is there, or at least the possibility of people looking at Madison and saying, Madison is the next Ferguson. To what degree do you see that or not see that?
I don't see that. In fact, we've said publicly from the outset that I think it's pretty clear for a wide variety of reasons that Madison, Wisconsin is not Ferguson, Missouri. One reason I just mentioned, that the representation of the department, the Madison Police Department is much more demographically representative of this community than was and is the Ferguson Police Department. I think the fact that Chief Koval, as one example, he met with the family of Tony Robinson that night. I think that was a great sign of respect for the fact that a family has suffered a tragic loss. And, you know, even yesterday, you know, you mentioned the police rally. Obviously, there were other rallies, and Chief Koval was marching with those people as well. And I think that kind of – it's just indicative, I think, of the view that the Madison Police Department, the philosophy that they have, and the importance that they place upon the perspectives of everyone in this community.
We're talking right now with Jim Palmer of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association about how police officers are grappling with the officer-involved shooting death of Tony Robinson.
And we want to hear from you. What questions do you have about police practices? Things like the use of deadly force, things like police community relations, too. Do you think the public needs to show more support for law enforcement? Are you? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also email talk@wpr.org.
We're hearing a police perspective on the shooting death of Tony Robinson in Madison last Friday and taking a look at the prevailing issues between the police and the public regarding race.
Jim Palmer is with us. He's executive director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association. And you can join in. What do you think needs to happen to build trust between the police and the public? And what do you want to know more about when it comes to how police do their job? Call 800-642-1234 or email talk@wpr.org.
And Jim, I want to get to our callers, but a quick briefly here, before we get there, last night a couple of officers shot outside the police department in Ferguson. What is your reaction to that?
Well, as a spokesman, I guess, for the law enforcement community here in Wisconsin, our hearts go out to the families of the two officers. One was a St. Louis County police officer. The other was a Webster Groves police officer. Obviously, they've in Ferguson, both the law enforcement community and the general public have really endured a difficult time, and that it's unfortunate that that has continued. And hopefully we can avoid that here in Madison. I believe we will.
And protests have been peaceful so far, but do you see that changing at all, for example, if the district attorney decides not to prosecute Officer Kenny?
I certainly hope not. I wouldn't. We'll have to cross that bridge, I guess, when we come to it. We're not trying to predict what the district attorney's decision will be, and that's why, out of respect for the investigatory process and the DA's process, we're really trying to refrain from comment on the specific facts because we want to respect their right to make their decision, and then we'll deal with it at that time.
Okay, we're going to go to our callers now. We've got Terry on the line in Milwaukee. Terry, hi.
Hi. First of all, when any of these incidents occur, I think everyone's in agreement that this is a tragedy, not only for the people involved, but for the survivors. But in response to the officer's comment about, respect for the investigation and holding off and making comments, I wonder whether or not in some of these cases that's the prudent thing to do. A protocol should be established, I think, for the early release of factual information based on real physical evidence that would explain to the public what actually happened. When some of these cases occur where it's reported that somebody got shot in the back and the medical examiner examines the deceased body and there's no bullet holes in the back, why that information would not be released immediately is baffling.
Terry, thank you for your question. Does it take too long for information to come out in circumstances like these?
I don't think so. This really allows to point out another distinction between what's been going on here in Madison and in Wisconsin generally in these situations when you look compared against something like what occurred in Ferguson. In Ferguson, as you may recall, there was a kind of dribbling of facts that came out. And, you have certain members on, and regardless of their perspective, that kind of, pounce on those facts and use that as evidence of a conclusion that's not based on the totality of the facts. And so we really believe that it's in the public's best interest to consider the facts in their totality.
And we've got a comment here, or a question rather, from Greg in Milwaukee, who wants to know, with so many other tools at an officer's disposal, why reach for the gun first? They have tasers, clubs, they're physically fit. Why the gun?
Well, that's a fair question, and I will try to speak generally without getting to the specifics. But there are a number of reasons. If someone is entering a premises or a situation that they believe to be dangerous and possibly lethal, they go in with the lethal resources at hand. If you believe that there's a crime in progress, as an officer, and you walk into that situation, you're not going to pull out your taser first. Conversely, if somebody has something that's less lethal, and you have the opportunity to use that those resources, then that would be appropriate.
Okay, well, thank you for that question, Greg. We're going to go next to Chris, joining us in Madison. Chris, hi.
Hi, good afternoon. My question is, what training do the officers go through on issues of white privilege and what it's like to be a minority in our citizenry? 80% of the juveniles in detention are African American when they make up less than 10% of our population, and that's a problem. I also was at the rally yesterday supporting Tony Robinson and made a specific point not to engage in the chants that were putting down the policemen because I believe all life is sacred. And when I said thank you to the police in front of other marchers, thanking them because they guided the march to the governor's mansion, some acknowledged me and some didn't. And clearly some were angry. And so it's a complex issue that tends to get reduced to sound bites. So I'm just wondering what training are officers put through to support them in these challenging situations, which is challenging just living in life in a country that has the courage to try and be diverse and multiracial.
Chris, thank you for that. A couple of issues there. What training do officers get in white privilege? And also just the complexity of the situation here, how officers are feeling, how different protesters are feeling. What do
sure.
you say?
Well, and at first, I also want to thank Chris for her question and for what she described in terms of her how she handled herself at the rally yesterday for in support of Tony Robinson. Not everybody has been that way. And behave that way. And so obviously officers know that that comes with the job, as I mentioned earlier. But it can be difficult to have someone, scream at you and call you a murderer. And you know, you're an officer who's just, trying to guide a march along and allow them and facilitate their expression of their rights of free speech. As to the question of training, I think it's a great question. I think it's the case. I'm confident that there's probably no department in the state of Wisconsin, where the officers undergo more training and sensitivity training or unconscious bias training than in the Madison Police Department.
Right. We've heard a lot about the term bias training. Can you tell us a little bit about what that is and what that training might involve?
Sure. A great question. And basically it involves a variety, just about every officer, I believe every officer has been subjected or has gone through this training in the last few years. And, it involves a variety of measures. They have people come in from the community that have had maybe a bad experience with law enforcement, and they go through hypotheticals. And it's designed to get people to acknowledge and gain an awareness of any individual biases that they may have. And the idea is that if you're aware of those individual biases, that you can be, and you're more cognizant of them, that you can better prevent them from, putting them into practice and somehow, interfering with your interactions with the public.
Now, an incident like this one, it can drive deep wedges in the community. It can breed resentment. How does a community come back from something like this?
Well, I think it. I think it won't. We won't have to come back from as far as maybe, the community in Ferguson will have to, because the expressions of speech and concern and the questions that have been asked. Again, I think even law enforcement officers respect the public's right to have these questions. And we just have to, wait until more facts are known. There is an investigatory report that will be released to the public, again, by virtue of a law that no other state has in the country. But then once we have all the facts, it will really require a genuine dialogue with all segments of the community in the city, and to explore whether or not improvements can be made and how best to achieve that.
And we heard from Chris. They're obviously feeling conflicted, lots of different feelings going around on all sides. What should citizens do if they want to reconcile some of the feelings that they're having, if they're feeling angry, for instance, about what happened or confused?
Well, I think, even law enforcement officers are angry. And they're not angry at people who express their point of view or raise questions. They're angry that this happened. I mean, they're angry that, we do live in a community where a young man has lost his life, and that is tragic. And so I think you just have to, we have to wait until we have more information. And then we really just, again, have to engage in a dialogue that includes all segments of the community. I think that really is the best way to heal and to learn and to possibly explore whether improvements can be made.
Does it seem too soon to be doing that right now? Are we at a sort of intermediary phase, or are we at the part where we can start to have those dialogues?
I think you can always start to have those dialogues. I don't think it's ever too early, frankly. And I think, it's important for, again, every segment of the community, including the law enforcement community, to have a voice at that table. And so that, people in the community that have concerns about how officers utilize force, they can learn a little bit more about that. And likewise, officers can learn more about the biases that they feel they're being subjected to.
Jim, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
That was Jim Palmer, Executive Director of the Wisconsin Professional Police Association.
Related topic, Friday night at 7:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio, we bring you a special half hour devoted to race and social justice with Wisconsin Public Television's Here and Now. Community leaders and police leaders from across Madison join the show to help bring greater understanding to the complex and deeply divisive issues facing the community, state, and country. That's Friday night at 7:30 here on Wisconsin Public Radio.